Next case of the day is in fact State versus Robertson. I am recused from this case and also from the last case of the day, which is Sohawk versus Bennis Service Company. Judge John Sampson, District Court Judge from the 6th Judicial District, will be joining the court for the argument in State versus Robertson. And I believe Justice Castle will be presiding. So give me a moment to get out of the courtroom and Judge Sampson to get into the courtroom. Thank you, Chief.
Justice Miller Lerman, as the senior associate justice, would ordinarily preside in the absence of the chief, but because she is appearing by WebEx today, she has asked me to preside, and I will be happy to do that. And we welcome Judge Sampson from the District Court for the 6th Judicial District to sit with the court this morning. There was a late development, which I will discuss as soon as I verify that we have the correct counsel. April O'Loughlin is appearing for the appellant, correct? Good morning. And Stacy Faust appearing for the appellee. In this instance, Judge Sampson had filed a late notice of information that counsel should be aware of for consideration of possible recusal. His notice indicated that he did not believe that it was such that he would be recused. But because it came so late, the parties didn't really have time to file anything in response to the notice. So I am asking this morning, is there any reason why either of you believe that Judge Sampson should be disqualified from sitting in this case? Very well. With that preliminary taken care of, and were you in the courtroom to hear the introductory remarks about masks and not wearing masks when you are arguing? Oh, very well. You may approach and you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. I would request 1 minute for rebuttal if possible.
Very well.
Your Honor, in this case, Appellant Cutter Robinson's rights of speedy trial were violated. I know that this court has a long-standing record in terms of speedy trial and the rights that are associated under 29-1207 and 29-1208. And I'm going to take up a well-battled ground before this court, and I'm going to address State v. Mortensen. In this particular case, Your Honor, my client was charged under an information on June 10, 2019. Under the dictates of 29-1207, speedy trial would have run absent any excludable times on December 10th, 2019. What you have in this case, an understanding that State v. Mortensen was done under a long slew of concern by this court of abuses by the defense, as outlined in State v. Williams and codified by this court at the suggestion of the court in the legislature under 29-1207. Aunt Justice White, Justice Wright said in that Williams opinion that he likened the abuses of the speedy trial system to a crocodile, with the state being Captain Hook and the defense circling like a crocodile and waiting for time to run out. I would agree that there were abuses that were conducted by the defense in that particular case. However, we've now gone full circle. And any time that this court establishes a bright line rule under criminal law or in any other law, the abuses potential by the state and the defense widen. We've now come circle, and I'm going to argue that the abuses by the state under State v. Mortensen under a bright line rule have gone beyond what is outlined by Justice Wright in A Crocodile and Captain Hook. I would argue now that both the courts and the states are able to wrap themselves in Mortensen for a Goliath versus David scenario. And in fact, the only tool in the quiver of the defense under Mortensen is that of a straw, not a slingshot, but a straw. In this particular case, 7 days prior to trial, the state amends the information over objection by the defense. The only, as this court has consistently ruled, the only remedy by the defense is to request a continuance. That puts in even the small window that we had in terms of requesting a definite versus indefinite continuance is now under case law gone. The only under the Mortensen, again, the David versus Goliath, is at the mercy of the court when that trial is set. In this particular case, the trial was set in January, pushing it past the December 10th trial date.
You don't quarrel with the math here.
I do not quarrel with the math. What I quarrel with is the bright line rule that, again, offers that the state can come in and abuse the system. There is no remedy.
What's the abuse? What's the nature of the, you've talked several times about something that was purportedly abusive. What was it?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, in June 10th, my client was charged under an information with one count. On September 10th, the state amended adding a second count.
What happened between the filing of the original information and the request to amend? Was there discovery provided that hadn't by the defense that hadn't been provided previously, or did that happen?
Correct. Correct. With the filing of the new charge, the defense filed a timely objection. With the filing of the new charge that was granted, the defense is placed in the untenable position of not being ready to go to trial 7 days prior to trial based upon the new filing of a second charge and the disclosure of police reports related to the second charge.
Has our case law been clear that the reason for seeking the continuance is simply irrelevant to the waiver inquiry?
And that, again, thank you, Your Honor, that's exactly what I'm talking about in wrapping yourself in Mortensen, both the court and the state. That was not the intention of the legislature in this court in addressing abuses by the defense. It now becomes under Mortensen irrelevant what the reason for the continuance is, and that is exactly the prejudice to the defense.
But we have a statute to interpret, right? We have 29-1207-4B, and whatever the reasons Williams or Mortensen might have talked about, and whatever metaphors of crocodiles and Captain Hook and Goliath and quivers, yes, I mean, we still have to interpret this statute, right? And how do we get around that the statute seems to say, if there's a continuance and it takes it past the date, it's waived?
That's exactly my point, Your Honor, is that that statute was put in place at the suggestion of this court in State v. Williams. We're now left with absolutely no remedy. The state has 29-1207-4 subsection B for a good cause. There is no remedy, no alternative remedy for the defense for the court to find good cause.
Is that an argument that needs to be made to this court or to the legislature?
I would argue it would be both. I would argue it would be both. The only remedy that we have as a defense is to argue under 29-1919 that there's a discovery violation or a sanction violation. That still is inconsistent with State v. Mortensen. It's inconsistent with the dictates of 29-1207 that mandate a speedy trial. Anytime you have a bright line rule that prejudices the defendant with no options, then that's where we get to the slippery slope.
When the continuous was entered here, did the defendant point out to the court when the 6 months was going to end and request a date before that?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would argue with all due respect under case law, that doesn't matter. We are entirely at the remedy of the court as to when the court sets that.
But in this situation, that did happen. The time frame was set forth to the court, so it knew it before it set the court date beyond it.
In terms of defense counsel or the court?
Defense counsel informing the court.
Well, in the specific motion, no, it does not specify a specific trial date that it requests that the trial date be set prior to the December 10th trial date. It requests a continuance and an objection to the state amending the charges to add a secondary charge so close to trial. And that's exactly my point, that's the only remedy that we have. The reason that it's relevant for this argument in terms of violation of speedy trial is in the court's opinion on the motion to discharge, as this court is aware, most analysis stops specifically with Mortensen. So if the court deems that there is a Mortensen violation, the analysis generally stops. That's a bright line rule that the defense cannot overcome. So I would argue that in this particular case,
are you arguing that the statute sets forth something other than a bright line rule?
I'm arguing that Judge, that's exactly, there needs to be some, and I understand the difficulty that the defense places in this particular case, that there is a statute that mandates that. However, it is a irremovable line that the defense cannot overcome. There is no remedy, no matter what the continuance, unless the court sets it within that.
But what authority do we have to create a remedy that the legislature hasn't? I mean, you're not arguing it's unconstitutional.
Well, Judge, what I'm arguing is that the same suggestion that this court made in State v. Williams for the legislature to set a waiver of speedy trial, a permanent and irrevocable speedy trial waiver, there needs to be the same guarantees that the state gets under 29-1207B, finding of good cause. There is no remedy or equilibrium in terms of that. Why this is important in this particular case, Judge, is especially highlighted with the COVID issue. In this particular case, and I would draw the attention why this case is even more important under Mortensen, is that the state filed a last minute charge as I've indicated for the court. In January, the state filed a motion to continue arguing late disclosure, and the court found good cause and continued the trial.
Can I go back to the first one? Because I get it, you don't like Mortensen, I understand. You think it's too broad, and I understand that. But the shenanigans you're talking about, that the state could come down and do all these things, that didn't appear to happen in this case.
I mean,
the judge set the trial date 3 or 4 months out, right, in September.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there were deposition motions that were granted. And as I understood the record, the defendant asked for a motion to continue with discovery, with the depositions, right? And the continuance was granted in September on that, and they moved it to January.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what happened?
Well, Your Honor, yes, but I'll clarify that.
Well, did the defendant object to the trial being set in January?
Well,
which was past the December 12th date you were talking about.
That's exactly correct, Judge. And
did the defendant object to having it moved out to January?
I would argue that the objection on the motion to joinder is exactly that the state on September 11th, defense objected to the state being allowed to amend the last argue for this very reason. Trial was set for September 17th.
Am I mistaken? The motion to continue was not based on depositions were ongoing. Was that incorrect?
The depositions would be related to the amended charge that was filed one day on September 10th, 7 days prior to trial.
And again, my question again, did the defendant object to the judge setting the trial in January of 2020 rather than before December 10th, 2019?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Why I would argue this is so important is, as I've indicated, that in this particular case, the state is allowed to request, through the last minute disclosure, a continuance and good cause is found. This particular case is exactly why Mortensen needs judicial scrutiny. In this particular case, on March 23rd, as this court is aware, there was a order issued by the district court judge, sua sponte, continuing the trial. In this particular case, it was set for April 29th. Well, under State v. Baird, my argument is that is an improper order. I know that this court's recently issued opinions in State v. Chase and State v. Brown. However, this case is distinguishable, that in this particular case, the district court judge improperly testified. There's no indication at that point in time, there was no evidentiary hearing. The state wants to argue that puts an undue burden on the defense to object to that.
At which hearing did the judge inappropriately testify? Was it at the March hearing when he sua sponte did things, or was it at the October or December one where the motion for discharge had been filed?
Judge,
which one did he improperly testify?
I would argue it on the March 23rd order that was held without any evidentiary hearing. The period of time from March 23rd to August 7th for the filing of the motion to discharge should not be counted against the defendant for speedy trial. Under State v. Baird, the court cannot testify, and as this court is aware in State v. Baird, that decision was overturned because the court testified on its own.
But on the motion for discharge, wasn't there evidence adduced at that time by the state?
I will distinguish our case from the facts in State v. Chase and State v. Brown.
In this case, though, wasn't there evidence offered by the state on the motion to discharge in this case?
I would argue that it's a matter of timeliness, Judge. The motion to discharge was filed on August 7th. It was set for hearing in October. It was continued. At that point in time, the state had still not filed anything related to the motion to discharge. And in fact, did not file anything until September 29th. That is a full almost 6 months past the March 23rd order. What they did then, as the court is aware, is simply attach the packet that the court referenced, which I would argue improperly as the court testified in that particular case. I would also argue, distinguishable from State v. Chase and State v. Baird, that there is not good cause. And I don't know that that yet, and if it's been argued before the court, I apologize, but I would argue that that has not been established. In its March 23rd order, the district court judge makes certain findings, makes certain references on his own. Specifically, he references affidavits from the jury commissioner, from the district, from the court clerk, and from other individuals that they could not safely accommodate due to conditions. However, those affidavits weren't filed until April 1st, a full week after this order was issued.
Counsel, you've gone somewhat over the time, and I've been waiting to see if there were any questions by any of the other members of the court. Are there any questions for counsel?
Yes, Judge Castle, Justice Miller-Lerman here. What is your take on the events at the hearing of the motion to discharge? In particular, were there objections to those things that the trial judge had done in March, which you characterize as testimony? Was there objection to that?
Yes, Your Honor, there was an objection filed, an objection to the motion to establish good cause. And it wasn't until the state became aware of the defense's argument in State v. Baird that they attempt to bootstrap it back and retroactively establish good cause. It's my argument that that's improper under State v. Baird, both for the state to do that and for the court to testify and issue testimonial findings on a March 23rd order. Finally, Judge, I would argue that—
I beg your pardon. So are you saying defense made objections to the admission of things that happened in March, which you characterize as judicial testimony? Was there an objection to incorporating that material possibly as evidence?
The argument would have been that it's an improper retroactivity, that a motion to discharge closes the record at the time that the motion to discharge is filed, between the filing of the information and the motion to discharge. I understand in this court's recent decision in State v. Chase and State v. Brown that this court draws a distinction between the court being permitted under 27201 to take judicial notice of territorial facts. I would argue and respectfully suggest that that's not what you have here. And if we're going to suggest that if in a specific territory that a court can take judicial notice of that and trials can be stopped inconsistent with Judge Hebekin's order, but trials are resuming, as in State v. Hassan in central Nebraska, that frustrates the very purpose of a speedy trial statute and a defendant's fundamental right to a fair trial. It doesn't depend on the territory in where the trial occurs. It depends on a defendant's absolute right to a speedy trial.
Thank you, counsel. How much time did we allow counsel to go over?
5 minutes and 19 seconds, Your Honor.
Very well. We'll add that time to the appellee's time, and we'll pause just a moment while the clock is programmed. And very well. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Faust, and I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. I was going to start out with the Chase and the Brown, but I'd like to address first this court's opinions in Chase and Brown. But I'd like to start first with the waiver and clear up some factual issues, because my recollection of the facts were as Judge Sampson explained them, that the defendant's own continuance was because the depositions were still ongoing, not because the state sought to amend the information to add account. The state's, when the defendant asked for the continuance, stating the reason was because the depositions were ongoing, the court had yet to even grant the state's motion to amend. And in fact, the state didn't even file the amended information until October. And this all occurred at the beginning of September. So as my brief stated, I don't think that there was any of this any bad things, the state was doing anything wrong here when the continuance was requested by the defendant. But this court can rely on its recent opinions in Chase and Brown to dispose of Robertson's statutory speedy trial claim as a whole. The state timely presented its evidence about the pandemic at the hearing on its motion to establish good cause, which I really see as a discharge hearing. And the court's continuance for the pandemic was for almost the exact same time period approved of in Brown, which was March to August of 2020.
Were the hearings on the motion to discharge and to establish good cause, were they held simultaneously?
No, so the state's motion to establish good cause occurred prior to the motion, the hearing on the motion to discharge.
Okay. Was there evidence, actual evidence received at that time on the motion for good cause?
Yes.
And was it the affidavits and things the judge relied
yes.
on there?
Yes.
And on the motion for discharge, was there any evidence offered during the motion to discharge?
The state just made it clear that it had already offered its evidence the prior hearing.
Does the state need to file a motion to establish good cause?
No. I suspect, as counsel intimated, that this whole Baird issue has kind of spooked the prosecutor, so he felt like he needed to file that motion and to do that because the court did enter the pandemic continuance sua sponte. He could have just done it at the discharge hearing, as this court said in Chase and Brown.
Do you know, on the October 5th hearing, the court, it's my understanding the court took judicial notice of, which is why I put the disclaimer out to you folks, judicial notice was brought up. The court took judicial notice of the governor's proclamation and the other things. Was the October 5th hearing, was that on the state's motion to for good cause, or was that on the motion for discharge?
It was on the state's motion. And it might have been confusing because when the state filed its motion to establish good cause, it attached all of that. The releases and the general orders, the affidavits and such. And at the October 5th hearing, which was on the state's motion, the court did take judicial notice at the state's request of the prior pleadings and orders, but then the state went on to actually offer them as exhibits, the attachments that had been to its motion in the file.
And I beg your pardon then, were there objections to the receipt of that material?
Based on untimeliness, which this court just rejected in Chase and Brown.
Nothing on judicial notice that you're aware of? No objections that evidentiary-wise it wasn't acceptable under judicial notice?
I don't recall, Your Honor, but I don't think it would have made a difference. This court just said in Brown that judicial notice of those types of matters are appropriate, but we have it as evidence here, so I don't know those results. I would just note that this case is factually different because in its order, the court gave Robertson its order continuing the trial because of the pandemic. It gave Robertson 7 days, well, the parties 7 days to object to the continuance, and neither party ever filed an objection. And to me, what that really did was transformed excludable time that would have been excludable under 4F for good cause into excludable time under 4B for consent, because by not objecting when he was specifically told that the court was willing to entertain an objection to its order, in my mind, is consent. In any event, the time is excludable. It's just that I've always understood 4F to be kind of a catch-all provision for other excludable periods of time not covered by subsections 4A through 4E. And so if it's covered under 4B, I've always believed 4F shouldn't apply.
Have we ever said, or I mean, certainly the statute doesn't say that there's some sort of hierarchy among the exemptions, right? That you have to decide if, whether it's a 4B before you can decide whether it's a 4F.
It doesn't say that specifically, but to me, the language or other periods of excludable time, the other is, it's not met by any of the ones preceding it.
So have we ever said that a court has to pick one of the 4A through E before it could consider a 4F?
No. No.
Do you see any reason for a rule like that? Are you advocating for a rule like that?
I think I'm advocating just based on my understanding of the statutory language. To the extent this court disagrees, no, I'm not advocating one way or another because it doesn't much matter. To me, it's excludable under, if you don't agree with me on 4B, it's definitely 4F here. If that's, you know, if that's what this court should find.
Do you take the position or do you have a comment on opposing counsel's characterization of the March material to the effect that was a judge testifying?
Well, what March material? As in Judge Cox's or general orders?
I believe, correct me on for my lack of knowledge of the record, but I believe that opposing counsel has just, quote, complained that a judge testified. And evidently that was done by incorporating whatever happened in March to the later hearing on the motion to discharge. Did a judge testify in this case?
No, Your Honor. I think her argument is based again on that Baird case, where the court was taking judicial notice of matters within his own personal knowledge, and that didn't happen here. In fact, the state introduced actual evidence at the hearing on its motion to establish good cause, which was essentially the discharge hearing. And those matters included, yes, its own orders, but within its orders were matters that were perfectly capable of judicial notice about the pandemic. And then also Judge Cox's, who's the presiding district court judge for Sarpy County then, his own orders canceling jury panels for 30 days and then extending for another 30 days. He's not the judge in this case. So we don't, again, he's not testifying either. Moving on to the waiver issue, the district court did find that Robertson waived. I absolutely agree. I think it's based on the plain ordinary meaning of subsection 4B and this court's case law on that, Mortensen, Gill, Bridgeford, that this court is not going to read meaning into a statute that is not there. It's a very broad provision, and we do not look at the reason for the request for the continuance.
And as far as the timeline is concerned, is it correct that when the defendant's motion to continue was filed on September 11th, the only reason given for that continuance was depositions were ongoing?
Yes.
And several days later, the defendant then objected to amending the information.
I don't recall if there was an objection to the amending information during the hearing on the motion to continue and when the state also asked to amend the information. I don't recall that, but I don't think there was actual filed objection.
Is the constitutional right to a speedy trial another arrow in the quiver or another remedy to deal with abuses by the state, if there ever are any abuses by the state with respect to the statutory speedy trial?
Prior to this court's recent decision in Short, I would have said that the defendant who asked for a continuance was still protected by the constitutional right to speedy trial, because to me that was where the reason for the delay would be considered. However, this court said in Short that a defendant cannot ask for a continuance in response to the state's late disclosure of discovery and later claim a violation of his constitutional right to a speedy trial. So to vindicate a right to speedy trial, the defendant has to choose, file a motion for discharge or seek continuance, knowing that if he fails to seek a continuance, then he may be forfeiting any other rights he has under the discovery statute. So yes, he does have the constitutional right to speedy trial to protect him, but he better be careful and choose and file that motion for discharge before he seeks the continuance to have that time to use that discovery to prepare for his trial.
But again, factually, in this case, the judge set the trial out. I think December 10th was the speedy trial date. Is that what it was? Early in December. And the judge actually set it for the next month in January, as I understand it.
It was set for September. And then it was continued to January, which was past what the
right. Yes. And that's my question: is was there an objection by the defendant to the judge, continue it into January of the next year, rather than trying to schedule it sometime before December 10th, which was the end of the speedy trial.
No, Your Honor. In fact, her motion stated just to a later date.
With respect to if we were to take the path you suggest with respect to treating this as a 4B continuance rather than a 4F continuance, would that have an effect under your interpretation of our opinion in short regarding the effect upon the defendant's constitutional right to a speedy trial?
Well, if you, they're independent, but they obviously affect one another. So if it is a 4B, you're looking at the reason for delay, and that was his consent. So it's just a factor to be considered, and I think the factor's not going to weigh in his favor then. But it doesn't make any difference. To answer your question, if you treat it as 4F pandemic, it's still not going to weigh in his favor because the 4F pandemic reason is a valid reason. So either way, the factor doesn't weigh in his favor, in my opinion.
Okay.
But I would note that first and foremost, when he asked for the continuance himself, the one to, because depositions were ongoing, that caused the waiver. That preceded anything else that happened in this case. And therefore, I think the waiver should be the appropriate route here to dispose of his statutory speedy trial claim.
And then we're in the constitutional arena.
Yes.
And we're, and it's been assigned as error, and I'm presuming it was preserved below.
Mm-hmm.
What's the state's view on that?
Well, I think the waiver would go to the length of delay factor. Obviously, if he's waived his statutory right to speedy trial, the factor doesn't weigh in his favor. In my brief, I've alternatively done a calculation with all the excludable days, the majority of which are attributable to him and the pandemic or his consent, if you go with 4B on that period of time. And so the length of the delay still isn't going to weigh in his favor. None of the factors, in my opinion, weigh in his favor. If this court has no further questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Is there any rebuttal time remaining? Very well, there is no rebuttal time remaining, and the cause is submitted and counsel are excused. Thank you, Judge Sampson, for joining us. We'll move on to the last case of the day, in which Chief Justice Hevekin is recused. And in this case, Justice Stacy is also recused, Bohawk versus Benish Service Company. I apologize if I've mispronounced anyone's name.